The next topic that will be discussed today is practical halachic estate planning, exploring the halachic effect and requirements of various testamentary vehicles, including wills, trusts, and halachic tzavah. I can say with a certainty that every one of us knows stories, horror stories of machlokes among in families over Yerusha's children with their mother or amongst themselves, and that's because the lawyer who helped them prepare the estate planning could have drawn a will or didn't draw, but did draw a will, but didn't take into consideration the halachic ramifications. So there's forum shopping. Should we go to Beis Din? Are we better off going to Beis Din, or better off going to a secular court to resolve the disputes? I think it's an obligation on every lawyer that does estate planning to know what you can do halachically to affect either your secular will or otherwise. So without any further ado, I'm going to introduce an expert in the field of Ari Marburg.
For both the introduction and all behind-the-scenes work making today's CLE possible. We just heard from Rabbi Gutman an entire hour about the halachic seder ha-yerusha. The default, what happens if a person dies intestate without any will, without any form of estate planning. And I think there's one takeaway. It's that the halachic default is drastically different than the legal default. And if a person dies without a will, without a trust, there will be a tremendous conflict. On one hand, the way probate will distribute the assets will depend on which state you're in, but certainly will not comply with halacha. And that will put a family in a very difficult situation. On one hand, you will have the spouse or you'll have daughters that have certain legal rights. And if they go to court to enforce those rights, they will end up with a percentage of the estate. But at the very same time, if in halacha they are not yorshim, under halacha they do not have the right to these assets, or at least the level of assets, you're putting them in a situation where if they simply go through the legal default, they are essentially being gazlanim. They're eventually stealing assets, taking assets that rightfully belong to their siblings, to their children, and you're in a situation. You're creating a very difficult situation that can destroy families, that can create tremendous machlokes. And in fact, many people can spend decades of their lives building businesses, creating wealth where they don't need it for themselves. They're creating that wealth for the future generations, and in fact, that very same wealth that they think is helping the future generations could be the source of great conflict and great machlokes. So what I'd like to focus on in the next hour or so is, on one hand, while we've discussed the halachic default, is a person allowed to change it? What are the methods and what mechanisms have to be put in place in order to effect a change? And lastly, if a person does not do any halachic estate planning, he simply relies on his attorney for a will and for a trust, how does halacha, how does Beis Din view these vehicles? So let's begin. In general, by every davar sheva mamon, when we're dealing with financial matters, a person is free to spend his money as he sees fit. And you look around, people have money. Some people choose to give it to tzedakah. Some people choose to gamble it away, either real gambling or on Wall Street. Others will spend it on vacations. People do different things with their money, and they're really free to do as they choose. When it comes to Hilchos Yerusha, the Mishnah tells us in Bava Basra, HaKoysev es nechosev l'akeirim v'yiniach es bonov. If a person writes his assets to others and he leaves his children penniless, he decides, instead of allowing the estate to fall with the Seder HaYerusha, he gives it away to others. Very often this can happen. There's conflict in the family. So he cuts his child out of the will. So the Mishnah tells us 2 points. Masha asli asli, what he did is done. In other words, it's your money. You can do as you see fit. And if you give it away in the proper way, which we'll discuss soon, then it's effective. And a person does have the ability to channel his assets and give it to people, even though they're not the halachic yorshim. But although you have the ability to do so, it'll work. But the Mishnah continues, Ela ein ruach chachamim noicha himenu. Chachamim are not happy with your actions. Now, chachamim not being happy with your actions is a bit of a powerful language. They're not happy, it doesn't. But never, if you look at the Rashbam there and the Achroinim, they say this doesn't simply mean they're not happy. It means they're bekas. What you're doing is wrong. And some of the Achroinim actually use a lashon of isser. So we see clearly is on one hand, a person has the ability to override the Seder HaYerusha and distribute his assets as he sees fit. Nevertheless, doing so is considered wrong. And when the Torah tells you that this is what should happen, a bechor, zachar, what a spouse gets, these are not simply a default, but this is the preferred course of action. In fact, the Mordechai writes, and it's quoted by the Ramah, that there was a person who on their deathbed handed a fellow a sack of gold coins and said, distribute these in the best possible manner. And with that, he dropped dead. So the testator now, or the executor, now had this question. What is the best possible manner? So you'd think it means you find your favorite organization, your favorite tzedakah, make a nice donation. Mordechai says nothing doing. If he says do with it the best possible thing, what he means is you follow the Seder HaYerusha. Give it to the Yarshim in the way the Torah says it should be given. And while he doesn't explain the reason, I think it's simple. If the best thing to do with a person's money was when he dies for it to go to charity, then that's what the halacha would be. If the Torah says when a person dies it doesn't go to charity, it goes to his children, it's because that's where HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants it to go. And the Chinuch actually explains that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives a matano, when people are blessed with wealth, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives a matano completely, until the end. Had Adam HaRishon not sinned, we would never die. And whatever he had, it would be his to enjoy indefinitely. Although because of our sins, that's not no longer true. People do not live forever. But nevertheless, the Chinuch says the present, the bracha that a person has, if he can't take it with you, at least you should stay within the family, with your children, with your people who you've left behind, and that way you're still benefiting from that present. So, be that as it may, clearly, the default Seder is not just a default, this is the preferred manner of distributing the assets. And changing it, the Mishnah says, is Ein Ruach Chachamim Noicha Himenu, is not the right thing to do. Now, as many of you have probably picked up by now, very few people, when they go to their attorney and draft a will, actually draft it based on the Seder HaYerusha. I've spoken to many people about their estate plans. I've reviewed many wills and trusts. I've yet to see anyone come in and say, my bechor gets pishnayim, daughters get nothing, spouse will get a ksuba. It simply doesn't happen. The question is why? This is a Mishnah that's saying you should not be modifying Seder HaYerusha. So over here there is a tremendous machlokes, but the Itzur is quoted by the Ktzoyis and many other Achroinim say the following chiddush. They actually have a girsa in the Mishnah, HaKlesev Kol Nechasev L'Acherim. The Mishnah is talking about when you completely disinherit your Yarshim. And this happens, unfortunately, too often. There's a fight in the family. Nebuch does not get along with the child. He cuts him out of the will. The Mishnah is telling us, Ein Ruach Chachamim Noicha Himenu, that's not an appropriate course of action. However, the Itzur says, if you leave over to each Yarish, Dalet Zehuvim, 4 golden coins, then you're not completely overriding the Seder HaYerusha. The Yerushim are each getting the Dalet Zehuvim. With the rest of it, you are free to distribute it as you see fit. It's your money, you can do what you want with it. Now, not everyone agrees with this. However, this is brought down by many Achroinim, and this seems to be the de facto practice in Minhag among Klal Yisrael, and this is what people rely on. That as long as your halachic Yerushim are getting something, you're leaving them Dalet Zehuvim, you now have the right to distribute the rest as you see fit, and that is what typically is done. Now, how much is Dalet Zehuvim? We do not have any coins Zehuvim anymore. But what the Poskim do say, the Gros Moshe and the Five of Kohen has a similar Hagdara, is what it means is you have to leave over a somewhat meaningful portion of the estate. In other words, it has to be an amount that has chashivas. You can't say that I'm leaving my son 25 cents and the rest I'm giving over and distributing as I see fit. It has to be an amount that has a certain amount of chashivas that's considered, money, it's considered real. That being said, it certainly should not be enough to create machlokes. And therefore, for most estates, people leave over, will carve out a few $1,000s. This will go to my sons, this will go to Pisei HaYerusha. It's enough, it's a meaningful amount, $5,000-$10,000 is money. But that being said, especially if it's a moderate or larger estate, it's not enough to actually cause machlokes, and that is typically the practice of what's done. Now the one case, the one which is most common where people violate this halacha unwittingly, is very often you have the so-called I love you wills, where a husband and wife will each write wills that are mirrors of each other, basically saying whoever dies leaves over the entire estate to the spouse, and then after that it'll get divided equally. Now, what that means is, if a husband predeceases his wife, the entire estate passes to the wife. Now, as Rabbi Gutman explained by Richus, the Yorish, a wife is not Yorish the husband. She has very significant claims of ksuba, of support, but she is not the Yorish. And therefore, in this typical simple will, where everything will go to the spouse, that is a case where you are completely disinheriting the Torah Yorishim, and that violates the halacha. And therefore, perhaps the most important takeaway of this year is that if you're drafting a will and you have a clause like that, there should be some sort of carve out where you put aside a few $1,000s that under any contingency will go to the Yerushim, go to the sons or whoever the Yerushim may be, al pisei de ha-Yerusha, so you avoid being over the sisser. For practical matters, the attorneys very often like putting this in the personal tangible property. It's simply just a little bit simpler than some of them putting it elsewhere. But it is important that under all circumstances, your Yerushim, which are typically the sons, they will get a share of the Yerusha, regardless, even if the husband predeceases the wife. Well, the father is the one that writes the will. So when he does this and gives it all to the spouse, the children have no input. And while the Ramah does imply that children can be meichel this halacha, but after the fact already, it's too late. So it's one thing the father wants to call the children in and say, will you be meichel me? Do you mind if I give it all to your mother? Which presumably they'll be okay with. But that's a rather awkward conversation that typically doesn't happen. So to be safe, an attorney, instead of going there, you're best off, I think, just making this exclusion. Again, it does not have to be a huge amount. It certainly does not have to be enough to create a machlokes. But in the very least, you're... Correct, they could be. Now, in all fairness, the Ramos was really talking about a case where the person died afterwards, they were doing a mechila internally and not taking what they were due. So you do not have a clear proof that you can cut them out with l'chadchila based on this Ramah. But I have seen some achroinim that made that jump and mechila would help. But in practice, again, if you're dealing with a few $1,000, it's a lot simpler to make a carve-out than to start having this conversation with your family.
Are you saying that it should be in the will itself, which causes all sorts of problems in a secular court, or can be in a different document?
It can be in any document as long as it will have teeth and it will be niskayim. Now, what I've seen very often is, the point that you raise is good. If you write in your will, $10,000 should go up Yisrael HaYerusha. You have an establishment clause, like what's a judge going to do? Bring a rabbi to testify whether there's a B'chor Pishnayim, Roy, Mukhsik, IRA, Staka. You know, you heard Rabbi Gutman's lecture, it would probably not go over very well in a probate court. What I've seen people do is, I'm leaving over this amount of money, the executor has the discretion to distribute it as he sees fit or based on instructions I've given him, and those instructions you write, you want him to follow halacha. If he has any questions, please consult with Rabbi so-and-so. So that's a way to sort of shift it out of the establishment clause issue, but you want it to have teeth. You want it to be something that will be binding and will actually go to the yarsh.
What about designating felonious harm? Have you seen that being used as a way to comply with that?
Designating?
Felonious harm.
Yes, yes. Now, interestingly enough, we'll get to it in a moment, there was a minute from... The practice was to give the daughters a significant share of the estate, known as a shtar chatzi zachar. Even that share, there were generally two exclusions. The svarim went to the sons, And the real estate, the house they lived in, went to the sons as well. Those, the daughters, were typically not given a share. Now, Svarim is rather understandable. The daughters themselves would have no use for the Svarim, and you have to realize this was pre the printing press. Svarim were extremely valuable, and they're something that really stayed in the family. It wasn't like you could just go to the Svarim store and buy a shas. So that was something, it was a very significant purchase. It was something that it would stay in the family, and that stayed with the sons. The real estate as well, people who owned a house, it was usually the family estate that was passed on from generation to generation, so that was also excluded. Today, real estate is generally not excluded, because for many people, that is a large chunk of their net worth, especially a more modest estate. And the svarim are sometimes excluded, but the value of a person's svarim are usually pretty minimal. By definition, when a person's dying when he's older, the svarim were printed many decades ago. The shelf life of svarim, especially today, where they're constantly coming out with newer ones, nicer prints, better prints, so it's usually minimal value, so I would not only rely on that exclusion. But tefillin, menorah, kiddush cup, this kind of thing I've seen before, and as long as it has a meaningful value, that is an effective way of doing of being mekayim this halacha.
I think the easiest simple way to do it is just say up front, I give first 10,000 or whatever it is going to be to the son or my children, and then left over the remainder to my spouse, etc., etc., and then do a shtar chatzi zachar.
Okay, so as far as what's most practical from a legal perspective, I'll leave that to the attorneys to debate it among themselves. I'll defer to whatever's easier for you, you can do. I've seen different ways, and again, the point that I'm making is it's got one way or another, the exclusion should be there. How you want to work it is really a matter of personal preference. So this is as far as the permissibility. The practice today is that once you have this carve-out, which will go up, Yisrael Yerusha, you can do what you want with the rest. But this leads us to the next question. When a person wants to engage in estate planning, legally there are many rules. The reason why we have attorneys that specialize in it is there are forms that need to be followed. There are tax issues. It is something that requires a level of expertise. And a person could come in and have all the intention of dividing his assets in a certain way. He can tell everyone what his intent might be clear. But if it's drafted incorrectly, if it doesn't follow the rules, doesn't meet the correct form, then in all likelihood, his wishes will not end up being honored. As we will see, halakha has its requirements as well. And a person can be very clear on what he'd like to do. But if he doesn't structure it correctly, and doesn't execute the appropriate vehicles, then it will very likely that it will not have any teeth in halacha, and we would revert back to the default Seder HaYerusha. So I'd like to really spend a few minutes talking about the different ways in which you can channel the Yerusha, the estate, as you'd like, how that impacts typical wills and trusts, and finally we're going to spend a few minutes to talk about Ishtar Chatzi Zachar, what's typically done in what we'll call halachic estate planning. So let's begin with a very basic idea. And that is, there's a concept of a kinyan, which if you've ever learned some Gemara or heard Shiurim about Kosh and Mishpat, it's a very basic concept. To transfer ownership of an item, it's not enough simply to want to do so. You tell someone, I'm going to give this to you, it might be a promise, it might be a commitment to do something in the future. But until there's a formal action that's done, which we'll call a kinyan, the actual ownership, there's no transfer of ownership. So you can talk from today to tomorrow how a person promises child that after I go, I'd like you to have this, I'd like you to have this particular asset. Or even in the context of a sale, you can tell someone, I'll sell you the car, this is the amount, this will be the cost, pay me and I'll give you the car. But until a formal kinyan is done, there's no transfer of ownership. Now normally that's not a problem. You sell your car the moment he pays for it, so payments will be a kinyan for karka, metalkalin. It'll only create a mishapara. When he takes possession of the car, that itself taking possession, meshicha, mesira, hagbah, depending on the item, taking possession is generally going to be a kinyan. And at that point, when the buyer takes possession, it's his, the deal is consummated. On the other hand, if it's just words, you just say, I will give this to you, I will sell it to you, and he says, okay, I will buy it from you. He may have a moral obligation to follow through because you gave your word. But the absence of taking possession, certainly in the absence of any payment, there's no enforceability to that commitment, to that promise to do something in the future. What is a will? A parent tells a child or a spouse, I am going to give you a large share, a share of my estate. What is the halachic toikif? What is the halachic standing of this document? So, there was just a verbal commitment, I'm going to give this to you, that will have no toikif. A verbal commitment is in halacha, like I said, perhaps a moral obligation, but does not affect the transfer. If you sign a contract, you're selling a house, you sign a contract. A contract, a shtar, is a kinyan. So perhaps executing a will is the equivalent of executing a shtar. That itself should be a kinyan, and that itself perhaps should be enough to bind the estate and to effect the transfer to the child, to the spouse, whoever it is that you wish to give a share of your estate. The problem is like this. The problem is, when you sell your house, you sign a contract, you sign a shtar, you sign the deed, you hand it over to the other party. The moment you hand over that shtar, the moment you sign over the deed, the transfer takes place. You've now given up ownership of the house, in exchange you've received a certain amount of money, and the deal is done. When a person executes a will, when in fact do the assets get transferred to the beneficiary? When he executes the will? No. It's when he dies, goes through probate, whenever the process is done. And at that point, the beneficiary will take possession of the assets that he's entitled to. In halacha, the moment a person dies, what happens to his assets? The moment he dies, everything flows to his yorshim. Everything flows to the people who, under halacha, are entitled to the estate. That happens immediately. It doesn't require any action, doesn't require any will, any shtar, any kinyan. That happens immediately and on its own. This creates a problem. Because if you create a will, even if you're going to argue that it's a valid shtar, a valid kinyan, because the kinyan is only taking effect after the person's death, at which time the assets no longer belong to him. They flow to the child immediately. There's a concept of ein kinyan lachar misa. You can't give away something that no longer belongs to you, because the moment the person dies, your ownership in the estate dissipates, and you simply can't give away something that's not yours. And therefore, even if we will accept that a will should be a kinyan, according to the vast majority of poskim, it cannot be effective for estate planning. Now, there is a very notable exception. Igros Moshe has a chiddush where he says the kinyan, he explains the kinyan happens at the time of death when you write a will, and he says the kinyan at the time of death somehow works. That is the sheet of Igros Moshe. Again, whenever Rav Moshe says something, especially in the United States, it's something that has tremendous weight. Rav Moshe was the poskim achron. However, it is a somewhat controversial psak. The Doilei Achronim, certainly in Eretz Yisrael and elsewhere, did not accept the reasoning, and therefore, midei sfeika loy nafka, it is certainly not a clear halach. So, as far as using a kinyan, it is a challenge to go ahead and justify relying on a will based on the concept of a kinyan. Now, there is another concept of divrei shchiv me'rach k'suvim l'chim surum dami, which is a person who is on his deathbed and who distributes his assets. There, the Chazal relaxed the requirement of a formal kinyan. The reason is simply the person on his deathbed does not have the presence of mind to start making kinyanim, picking up handkerchiefs, writing shtaris, and that's the last thing that he needs on his mind to be worried about bringing in a rabbi and a bezdin and getting all the forms correctly. And therefore, the Chazal relaxed the requirements. In order to make it easier for a person, that this should not be on his mind, it should not be an additional stress, they said even a verbal distribution is okay. Now, divrei shchiv me'rach is a halacha psuka. No one argues on it. However, in the context of estate planning, it is not very practical. Because hopefully people are doing their estate planning well in advance of being a shchiv me'rach. Hopefully, any estate attorneys here do not get called down to the hospital on the fellow dealing with people on their deathbed. Hopefully, people are planning well in advance. In which case, they do not qualify for a matan shchiv me'rach. They are not a shchiv me'rach. They're healthy. It may be in anticipation of their eventual death, but according to the vast majority of places, even a mitzvah machmas misa, if they're healthy, if they are a bari, the distribution will not be effective without a kinyan, without an effective kinyan. So we seem to be stuck. We seem to be stuck that a legal will would be difficult to enforce because it's only effective after death, which from a halakhic point of view is problematic. So this brings us to the concept of mitzvah l'chaim d'brameis. And that is, the Gemara in Gittin explains that if a person gives over instructions how he wants his assets to be distributed after his death, even in the absence of a kinyan, no formal transfer took place, nevertheless, there is a mitzvah l'chaim d'brameis. There is a mitzvah to fulfill his instructions and to carry it out. Now, this is not a kinyan per se. It doesn't automatically transfer. However, Beis Din will force the Yorshim to be mekayim to fulfill the wishes of the Meis. Now, if that's the case, if a will is a set of instructions what should be done la'achar mitza, how the assets should be distributed after his death, the mitzvah should apply. And we should be able to force the Yorshim to comply with the instructions and with the and of the will, even in the absence of a formal kinyan. Now, this is not that simple. Because, although it's a machlokes rishayim, but the Rama paskins, there are a number of requirements to qualify for mitzvah kind of remes. Most notably, if you simply, the testator simply says, this is how I want my assets distributed, that will not be binding. You have to actually escrow the assets by an executor, by a third party, with the instructions, hold on to these assets, when I'm gone, this is how I want them distributed. You have to escrow them. You have to put your money where your mouth is. You have to show you are very serious about these instructions. It's not just talk. Once you've done that, once you've given it beyond shlish lakach, you've given it to a shlish, to an escrow agent, at that point, this mitzvah will apply, and Bezin would force the Yorshim to comply. Now, if a person actually takes his assets, transfers them to a third party, and says, after I die, this is how I want them distributed, you will have this mitzvah kind of Devar HaMeis. However, in the absence of that, when they're not actually physically transferred to the control of this third party in order to comply with these requirements, their mitzvah kaim devar HaMeis will not apply, and there will be no way to enforce the person's wishes. Okay, very good, very good. Now, although this is a clear halachic requirement, again, it's halachic mefreshes in Shulchan Aruch, you need hushas l'kach. Nevertheless, there are a number of achronim that say a civil will have mitzvah kaim devar HaMeis. Now, some say because there's an executor, and that executor has control of the assets, and therefore, it's the equivalent of physically escrowing it by the third party, Hoshul Kokach, because he's given the control over the assets in order to distribute it. Now, as a technical argument, that's open to attack, because the executor himself doesn't get any rights or any control until after death. And for mitzvah kaim d'brei HaMeis, you need that at the time you gave the instructions, you actually turned over the assets to the escrow agent, the person who had the ability to comply with the instructions. That being said, a number of achronim learn. Let's take a step back. Why do you need hushas l'kach? Why do you have to escrow the assets for your instructions to have teeth? The reason is that when you just say something, it's just talk is cheap. And words themselves do not create any binding enforceable obligations. When you go ahead and you escrow it by a third party who now has that asset, you know good and well he's going to listen to your instructions, that raises to the level of smichas das, and at that point, it's not just talk, at that point, we say that is enforceable. Based on that, the argument can be made, and is made by a number of achronim, that when you write a civil will, you may not be technically complying with the requirement of hushas l'kach. There's no physical escrow agent until death. But since the practical bottom line is, you write a will, the probate court will enforce it. You write a will, you know this is what will happen to the assets. That shows the same level of smichas das, the same level of seriousness of hushas l'kach. And therefore, a number of achronim say that a will create an enforceable mitzvah l'chaim d'brei HaMeis. Now, not everyone agrees to this. However, there are a number of achronim that do follow this, that a will, even though it is not a kinyan, even though it's technically not hushas l'kach, nevertheless will create a mitzvah l'chaim d'brei HaMeis, and it will be enforceable.
That that might be binding on the nifter or the yorshim, but how can you ask the executor if it's against halacha? Aren't you misayel lo ravera? The halacha says it goes a certain way, and the executor, who is an outside party, he can go and follow against the halacha.
Well, no, halacha says there's a default seder hayerusha, but the entire concept of mitzvah kind of reyames. By definition, the mitzvah, the Divrei HaMeis, is obviously not consistent with the Seder HaYerusha. Otherwise, you don't need his instructions. It happens automatically. So the entire idea of mitzvah Divrei HaMeis is that the testator has the right to say, I'm giving you these assets, I want you to distribute it in a different manner in the Seder HaYerusha. And the entire takana is that he has an obligation to do so. He's not violating halacha as long as this carve-out was made. Now, there are those that say, let's say there's no carve-out. Let's say you violate halacha, you totally disinherit your son. At that point, your divrei hames might be aser, and to the extent that it's aser, it's possible that there's no obligation to listen to it. But, assuming people were here for the first half of this year, they complied with halacha, they made their carve-out, no one's violating any iser of havaras nacha, then there's a mitzvah to follow the instructions, even though you're modifying the Seder HaYerusha. Now, this is as far as a legal will, so although it's not a Kenyan, the Rav Moshe holds is a Kenyan, others argue, but nevertheless, many say there's a mitzvah kind of reyamis. What about a trust? So if money is put in a revocable trust, and it is self-settled, the grantor is the trustee. So in that case, really nothing happened, because the grantor still has control of the assets. It's not hush or shlokah. At most, you can argue it is similar to a will. It's a document which, although technically is not hush or shlokah, nevertheless, it certainly shows a seriousness because the instructions will be followed, and therefore the poskim that accept a civil will as binding because it's the equivalent of hushul lekach would presumably do the same for a revocable trust where the settlor is the trustee. In the next case, where the trustee is not the settlor, there you could argue that this is a classic mitzvah kaim divrei hames, because essentially you created a trust. You've installed a third-party trustee that immediately has control over these assets, and the entire purpose of the trust is to have the instructions what to do after the settler's death. So this would be a classic mitzvah lekayem divrei hames without any chidushim, without jumping through hoops, and therefore a revocable trust where there's a third-party trustee. There, I would argue that everyone would agree it would be binding in halacha because of the concept of mitzvah lekayem divrei hames. Now, although it's revocable, you can change your mind at any time. That is not a problem because every mitzvah lekayem divrei hames, it's just words. Before the person dies, he can change his mind. He can pull back his instructions, and he has every right to do so. And nevertheless, if he doesn't, the mitzvah mekayim will apply. So a revocable trust as well, although he could be pulled back, since it is transferred to the trust with these instructions of how to be distributed, the mitzvah would apply, and that should be binding in halacha. Now, an irrevocable trust would presumably be even stronger. In an irrevocable trust, the assets are being transferred irrevocably during the testator's lifetime, or testator's actually not the right word, but during the settler's lifetime. The moment it's given away, it's no longer his. It now it belongs to the trustee, has it in trust for the class of beneficiaries. At that point, if it's no longer his, Yerusha should not apply. Yerusha is is something that applies to the assets that belong to a person at the time of his death. If he's gifted them away during his lifetime, when he dies, he doesn't own it for there to be any Yerusha, for there to be any Hilchus Nachlus, and therefore, it should be binding in Halacha regardless. Now, there is an interesting question. I don't want to spend much time because it's more in the lumdus and the mechanics, and that is, do you find the concept of a trust in Halacha? It's a very unusual ownership, where a trustee has it, but, you know, who owns the asset? The settler gave it away. Beneficiaries don't have it yet. So the trustee is holding on to it, but can't use it. He only has it in trust for the beneficiaries. We do find a Gemara that has a very similar concept with a kinyan amanas lahaknas. The Gemara in the Dorm Daf Mem Ches discusses a case where there's a person, his child was a bum, he was busy stealing from him. The father decided to disinherit the child, which is against halacha, but that's not the point of the Gemara there. The son tells the father, wait a second, what if my child or my grandchild doesn't follow my footsteps, he follows your footsteps, he's an upstanding fellow, Why should they be deprived of their share of the Yerusha? Father says, you have a good point. So I'm going to give it to you. It's a kinyan amanas lahaknas. I'm giving it to you, but you have no right to use these assets. Your sole right is that if you have a child or grandchild who is a decent human being, you're going to turn over the assets to him. And the Gemara has a machlokes whether that's effective or not. L'halacha, it is effective, and certainly with me'achshav it'll work, which is the case of most trusts. So you see clearly that the idea of giving over assets to a trustee, where he will have no right to benefit from it, his sole right is to give it over to a beneficiary in the future, even though that beneficiary does not exist, it's a child that will be born in the future, we don't even know whether there ever will be a beneficiary. The trust may fail because of a lack of beneficiary, and halacha would have that concept even if legally you don't. But you see clearly that this concept exists of giving it over to a trustee in order for him to pass it on in the future to a beneficiary. So in halacha, I believe an irrevocable trust would certainly be effective. It would not depend on hilchos nachlas because there's no Yerusha. It is out of the estate immediately upon the transfer. Now, two words of caution. The first is, as you can imagine, there is very little halachic precedent about how to deal with an irrevocable trust, or for that matter, a revocable trust. So I can say my opinion for what it's worth. Nevertheless, it would be advised not to rely on that because if there is an issue, you could have other Batei Din or other Rabbanim who have a different opinion, and therefore to rely on something which is untested simply because you went to a C.L.E.S.H.I.R. Perhaps is not the wisest course of action. On top of that, there is, even whenever the money is transferred to trusts, I don't need to tell you, there's a certain amount of ambiguity where money is transferred into a trust with certain expectations that the settlor or the grantor will be able to, if not have direct legal control, but at least informal control. Now, I'm not confident to offer whether that's legal or not legal, but you certainly are open to attack in a Beis Din that perhaps the transfer was done for other purposes, but in practice he didn't give up control, and therefore there's always room for litigation over what the real intent was and whether this transfer was really a good transfer. Now, obviously, again, the counter argument would be is this is what the papers say, we will follow the papers, what will happen in Beis Din, who knows? But again, it's another reason to exercise some level of caution before just relying on this document, especially if, you know, again, if the circumstances under which it's executed are somewhat questionable. So let's talk now for a few moments about halakhic estate planning. How does a person set up his will or his trust in a war? How does he transfer assets in a way that will be clearly binding halakha? So we mentioned the classic way of transferring assets is a kinyan. A kinyan, you do mashicha, hagbah, a kinyan sudr, but you all know when you sell your chametz, the rabbi hands you a handkerchief, you pick it up, and with that, you're somehow either making a mashliach to sell your chametz. That's a kinyan. So if a person wants to distribute his assets, the simplest way to do so is to actually make a kinyan. Decide who gets which asset, be makabel kinyan, and say I'm immediately transferring the house to my wife, the car to my son, and however you want to distribute the assets. Now the problem with a regular kinyan is that once you do a kinyan, it's irreversible. First of all, it's his. You can't change your mind. And second of all, you lose immediate control and benefit of the item. So, since that is not the purpose of estate planning, what's very often done is a kinyan mehayoyim ulachar misa, which means you make a kinyan today, it starts effective immediately, because if it's effective after death, we have a problem, but it's mehayoyim ulachar misa, which essentially means you're giving over the actual item to the beneficiary, but you're retaining the payroll, so you're retaining the ability to use the item, a lifetime estate, if you will, you have the ability to use it until a death, but the actual underlying asset belongs to the beneficiary immediately. Now, this solves one problem. You're able to use the asset. It doesn't resolve the other issue. What happens if you change your mind? What happens if your needs change, your children's needs change, you want to shift the assets? So there what's done is, the kinyan is done, mehayomu l'achar misa, b'tnayim l'yachzer b'. There's a condition. You say, I'm giving it to you today. The asset's yours today. I have lifetime use, provided I don't change my mind. If I change my mind, I have the right to undo the deal. It's conditional. And by making such a tenai, you're protected. The kinyan starts immediately. There's no problem with lachar misa. The testator has the use of it until his death. And if he changes his mind, he has every right to do so. The problem with that is that this works well when a person has a fixed level of assets and he knows exactly what asset he wants to go to who. However, when a person is doing his estate planning when he's younger, which is certainly the way it should be done, he doesn't know what assets he'll have when at the time of his death. His plans, or at least his dreams, are to amass huge fortunes between now and his death, and you can't make a king and give away assets that you don't yet own. So while for an elderly gentleman who's not working anymore, this is what he has, this is an effective way of distributing it, for a younger person who doesn't know what he'll end up with at the time of his death, this is problematic. You cannot make a kingdom on things that you do not own. On top of that, while real estate is pretty straightforward, how to divide, there are things like debt, or for that matter, if you own stocks, you own investments in mutual funds, picking up a sudr, a handkerchief, is a very problematic way to transfer debts or true stocks. There are all sorts of rules, legals, tumta. Some people do it when they sell their chametz, but it's highly questionable whether it's really effective. And therefore, there's many financial assets that a person has, which very often is a good chunk of his wealth, cannot be transferred with a classic king. So this idea may work well, and this is historically what was done. In today's day and age, when you're planning in advance, and many assets that we have are aimed by mamish or like olam, it's not effective it's certainly not a complete solution. So this brings us to the concept of a shtar chatzizah. If a person wants to distribute his assets, he'd like to make a kinyan, but we pointed out, you can't make a kinyan on assets that you don't own. You can't make a kinyan on things that you don't know what it will be, how much it will be. So a shtar chatzizah is a mechanism to force your yorshim to obey your wishes, even in the absence of a binding kinyan. So this is how it's done. Now there are a lot of technical details I'm going to grossly oversimplify just to give over the flavor, and then time permitting, I'll go through some of the more technical details. We begin as follows. The testator, assuming his estate is worth $1 million, and let's just keep it simple, he has a son, he has a wife, he'd like it all to go to the wife, he'll carve out a few $1,000 for the son, everything else he'd like to go to his spouse. Now, to transfer it directly, we have a problem with the kinyan. So he does the following. He signs a document, a shtar chatzizah, where he states that he owes his wife $1 million. He has a debt. Now, legally, you would need consideration. You want to create a debt. In halacha, there's no such requirement. If you write in a document, I owe you $1 million, you sign the document, there's an appropriate kinyan, you now owe $1 million. So step one is you write, I owe a spouse $1 million. Step two is you say like this. I have a will that says the spouse should, let's say, get $900,000, $100,000 should go to the son. If my son complies with my will, complies with all the instructions in my will, in my trust, in whatever estate planning I have, then this debt that I created is null and void. In other words, the debt is conditional. That if the child, if the Yorish said, gets up in Bezdin and says, I'm the Yorish, it belongs to me, throw out the will, it's not binding. Bezdin will say, okay, it's true, you're the right Yorish, you get the money. But the Shtar Chatzizah says that your father obligated himself $1 million to his spouse. That's payable. And you may be entitled, as a Yorish may be entitled to the assets, but now we're going to collect those assets to satisfy the debt. In which case, the son will end up with nothing. Because he's the Yorish on the asset, but there's this $1 million debt owed to the mother, which the mother will now be able to collect those assets and take everything away, so he'll be left with nothing. He now has another choice. Instead of contesting the will, instead of claiming, I'm a Yorish, I'm entitled to the assets, the note says that if he complies with the will, he voluntarily, in quotation marks, he voluntarily decides, I'm going to honor my father's wishes, I'm going to let mother take $900,000, then this debt is null and void. In which case, whatever the will left for him, he will keep, and everyone will live happily ever after. So this shtar chatzizah is essentially creating a stick. It's telling the person, it's true, in halacha, the yorishim will get the assets because they are the yorishim, it flows to them, we're not tinkering with that. However, at the same token, we're creating this debt, this obligation, to the legal beneficiaries. And if the Yorish want to exercise their halakhic rights and take the assets, The debt will vest, and they'll end up losing everything. Therefore, they will make a quick decision and say, if I claim my halachic rights, I'll end up with a debt, I'll end up with nothing. I am better off complying with the wishes of my father, complying with the will, in which case the debt is null and void, and I'll end up with whatever I'm entitled to. Now, obviously, if you leave your halachic yerush with nothing, this is not going to work, because there's no downside in him contesting the will. He's not getting anything. There's nothing for him to lose. But as we mentioned earlier, regardless, you should not be cutting out your halachic yerushim. You should be giving them something. And this is another reason. You have to give them enough that they now have something to lose. They will not contest the will in Beis Din, because by doing so, they will lose whatever amount it is that the will gave them. So again, the way this works is, you start off by creating this debt, and it's conditioned on the children of the Yerushim complying with the will or trust. Now, there are a number of benefits of this structure. Number one, you can just do it. You don't necessarily have to know what the terms of the will and the trust are. And for that matter, you can create this debt subject to compliance with the final will and trust. And even if it changes over time, the testator goes ahead and redoes his will. Every 6 months, he goes ahead and does it again. It doesn't matter. Because with the note, this obligation is conditioned that if you comply with the final terms of the last will and trust, the debt is null and void. If you contest it, if you make problems, then the debt kicks in. Now, when you're doing this, just a few simple pointers. Number one, the obligation obviously has to be enough to deter the yerush, which means it has to be at least as large, if not greater, than the amount that the beneficiary is getting under the legal will. Because you want it to be that the yerush is better off keeping quiet, better off paying the beneficiary what the will calls for than contesting it. So obviously the debt has to be at least as great as the benefit that they're getting under the legal will. In addition, when you're doing this, many of the forms require you to create this obligation to every legal beneficiary who is getting more than is entitled to al pi hilchos yerusha. Now, typically, that will be a spouse, that will typically be a daughter. In the case of Bechor, it will be every one of the children other than the Bechor. So you make the obligation to each and every one of the people who are getting more under the legal will than they are based on the Seder HaYerusha. If you have any questions, sit down with your Rav and identify who those people may be. And therefore, to each and every one of them, you have this obligation, and that forces their compliance with the instructions.
Why are you worried about them challenging under any? If there's $1 million estate, and he says, "I have a debt to my wife, $10 million." Well, what's the problem? Is it debt? There's nothing left.
That's true, and it's the wife. But if you're not giving it all to the wife, you're giving some to the wife and some to a daughter. So then he can say, "Okay, what you're leaving the wife, I'm not going to contest. I'll contest the share that's to my daughter."
It's not a question of contesting share; it's a debt.
No, understood, but it's only triggered by contesting. So you can contest against one beneficiary, not the other. Again, the details we'll talk about afterwards. I just want to end off briefly, just to briefly summarize. We started off with the idea of the Isser HaVaros Nachla. Changing the Seder HaYerusha is Usser unless you make sure that every Yerush gets something. We then discussed some of the challenges or problems with civil wills. It is a machlokes. Nevertheless, I do want to make it clear that if someone's in a situation where a parent died with a legal will, number one, both Rav Moshe and the other Rachbainim with Mitzvah Kan Divrei Meis, there certainly is very large halachic weight that a legal will or a legal trust should be honored and should be enforced, and even in the absence of a tzavah, even in the absence of a shtar chatzi zachar. I'm not chatzi shalom coming up here to say that people should start machlokes, people should start fights. Certainly, if a parent left clear wishes, many shittos will hold it's enforceable. Even if it's not enforceable, many others say there's a mitzvah of kibud av, or at least the inyan, if not the technical mitzvah, that certainly the appropriate thing to do is if there are instructions, follow the instructions, don't make problems, don't make machlokes. The idea of a shtar chatzi zachar is really from the other angle. If a parent or if a testator is sitting down to write his estate plan, if he knows there's any level of tension in the family, if he knows there's any possibility that a child, a sibling, a son-in-law, someone will contest it, someone will if there's any room for a machlokes, then certainly the wisest course of action is to nip it in the bud, to make sure that what you're doing is rock solid and just to preclude anyone from even thinking of making a challenge. And in that case, certainly the prudent thing to do would be to write a shtach etz zacher and make sure that according to all shitas, you have something which would be valid. Okay, we're going to stop for a break. I'll be happy to field questions during the break.